The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A flood of big media news this week. It's just kept coming. Brian Williams is benched by NBC. Jon Stewart calls it quits at The Daily Show after a 16-year run. Bob Simon of CBS dead in a car wreck. And then towering media critic David Carr of The New York Times collapsing in the newsroom, dying yesterday at 58. It feels like a watershed. This hour on Point, who do we trust in the world of news, of entertainment, or some hybrid to tell us the truth about the world we live in? NPR's David Folkenflik and Zara Kessler of Bloomberg View join me in a moment. But joining me first today from New York City, Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent for CNN, where he is the host of Reliable Sources, long a colleague of David Carr at The New York Times. Brian Stelter, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here. And I'm sorry for your loss. I know you were very close to David Carr.
Thank you very much. David was one of a kind, and I'm still grappling with trying to speak about him in the past tense. I think the stories I tell are the stories so many young journalists tell about his mentorship. And for me in particular, David, he treated me like a son. And I think I'm fully coming to terms with that this morning. I'm actually standing in the same room I last saw him on Wednesday night. He was here at CNN taping an interview about Brian Williams and all the other big media news of the week. And we, of course, gossiped. We talked about NBC. We talked about the Times. He asked about my wife. He even gave me vacation tips, some good advice for a trip I have coming up. And then he said goodbye and gave me a bear hug. He was just the kind of man that was so generous, both in his work but also in his personal life. And for me, I lost my father 14 years ago. He was the closest thing to a father that I had. I think there are so many others who have similar stories and similar memories of him. For readers, of course, he explained the media revolution, you know, in ways no one else did or could. But for people, his friends and family and his colleagues, he was so much more than that. He was so generous and so such a giant, as you said, a towering figure.
Let's hear the voice of David Carr for just a moment here. Here he was in conversation with Bloomberg Media Chairman Andrew Lack. This was just last year. David Carr, great media critic for the New York Times, scoffing at the idea of a vanished golden age of journalism, saying technology can make journalism better.
We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about back in the day. Back in the day, for one thing, it's gone. For another, you know what? It wasn't really all that great.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
If you think about in real time, we can now know whether what the source is telling us true or not. If they're ducking us, we can stalk them on Facebook. We can get them on LinkedIn. We can pop up on Twitter. We can guess at what their email is. The bag of tricks that the average journalist has is so much bigger.
Brian Stelter, you've been talking with David Carr just in this week before his unbelievable and talk about untimely death. But how did he see what we're in the middle of right here? Brian Williams benched Jon Stewart with all of his impact, quitting at Daily Show?
David was not feeling well this week. Others have said that he was sick this week. He was coughing on stage when interviewing Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras
yesterday,
last night,
right? Yeah.
At the New York Times. You know, on Wednesday, though, he told me this was too big a story. He knew he had to be in the middle of it like no one else can be. And that was always David's spirit. I remember him saying that about stories like the WikiLeaks break and other big media stories of the last decade or so. He always wanted and needed to be in it because he was able to explain it like no one else. I really think in many ways, David Carr, he was able to he was figuring it out with the rest of us, and he was able to put it in a language no one else was. You knew as this media chaos happened, all these changes technologically and in terms of talent, even on the television, he was able to put in the bigger perspective that was necessary. And he was also, as we just heard in that soundbite, able to bring some hope and some optimism. And I think that comes from David's roots. He was given a second chance in life, and he always viewed the Times as a great gift, having struggled with drug addiction in his in his 20s, and he wrote his book, The Night of the Gun, about that. Because he had that second chance, I think it gave him an optimism and a spirit that we saw in his writing. And what's made him so vital, it's what made him so vital, and it's why this is such a punch in the gut this morning.
Brian, we trusted David Carr. You know, we talked with him yesterday by email about talking this morning. Who do you trust now in the media to understand the world?
Well, I think there are so many greats, and I share David's sense about this being a new golden age, despite all of the turmoil. I still pick up the New York Times and trust the New York Times. I believe that institution, which he cared for so passionately, is still among the best. He had a love, a ferocious love and passion for the Times that no one could match. I would say the greats like NPR and the New York Times and CNN are still, and NBC, despite their struggles, are still producing excellent, and in some cases better than ever, types of journalism. But they're being joined by these new digital upstarts. They're being joined by the BuzzFeeds of the world that, yes, include some entertainment and have some fun and have some silliness, but are producing real reporting. That's why I share David's optimism for this time.
Brian Stelter, we've read your tweet, so we know you wrote, "He's been the closest thing I had to a dad about girls' bosses' life. He always knew what to say, what to do."
And now I don't know what to say about him, but that says it all.
We well understand. Our heart is with you to lose a colleague and mentor like that. We're grateful to you for spending a minute with us today in this amazing week of media news. Brian Stelter with Reliable Sources on Scene. And thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
All right. What a week in media news. And we're very glad to have with us from New York right now, David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. David, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom.
And with us from New York, Zara Kessler, editor for Bloomberg View. Her recent piece was headlined, "Stewart Matters More Than Williams." You can link to that from our website, onpointradio.org. Zara Kessler, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much.
There's so many angles to look at here. But Zara, let me come first to yours, because Brian Williams had the whole headline stage to himself. And then in quick succession, we got Jon Stewart and we got Bob Simon, tragically, and tragically, David Carr. But your thesis, I mean, there would have been a time when the idea of a news anchor being banished from his chair would certainly trump one-time comedian leaving his chair. You say Stewart's more important in our media landscape. Why?
I just think that, I mean, because of coincidence, these two events happen at the same time, and that causes us to pause and think about where we are in the media landscape. And especially for young people like myself, I really think that, you know, we've come to a point where satirical news or quote-unquote fake news matters more than, you know, the network news. We're getting our political and our cultural commentary in large part from people like Stewart. And, you know, you don't really think of in your mind that many young people tuning in to network news. We are getting straight news in a lot of various ways. But in terms of our context for thinking about politics and thinking about the news media itself, it's figures like Stewart who are really kind of moving the conversation forward.
Zara, how old are you now?
I'm 24.
24. David Folkenflik, jump in here. We're talking because someone.
I'm not 24.
Okay,
for the
fine. We'll let that stand. But so many big pieces in motion in media this week. What do you make of Zara? 24-year-old Zara's. I mean, incredible. You can certainly argue it. But point that at this point, Daily Show, in a way, she's saying more important than NBC.
Well, look, she's a professional journalist like the rest of us. I think she's both experiencing and observing a phenomenon which is real. Brian Williams, clearly a much bigger audience every night, seen by until his recent suspension, more than any other television news broadcaster in the country. But at the same time, Jon Stewart, I think, doing more to shape the sensibility of the nation and as I've argued this week, done more to sort of invent a form of both political satire and a kind of media criticism done through humor that unpacked both the political rhetoric that misled at times, and the laziness of journalists who perhaps weren't doing their own jobs. And so I think that the footprint that Stewart leaves and also, you know, that led, I think, very directly to Stephen Colbert's different take, his parodic approach to exposing the buffoonery of cable punditry, John Oliver's quasi-journalistic, quasi-satiric half-hour weekly on HBO Now, you know, that he leaves a legacy larger than his own show. And, you know, my God, he was on Comedy Central for over a decade and a half. That is quite a run. And for him to go out on top at a time that, you know, Brian Williams has been suspended and perhaps is gone forever from NBC's airwaves at the low point of his career, as the New York Times rightly noted, I think highlights the contrast between the two. I do want to leave a chit on the table for us to come back and circle back to Bob Simon, just because of what an important and underappreciated figure I think he is in broadcast journalism. But I do think that John Stewart being gone from the airwaves, as much as I have enjoyed and respected Brian Stewart Brian Williams until this point, that Stewart has had a larger effect in shaping the media ecosystem.
Much to say about all four, and we will in this hour. This was John Stewart on the night before his big announcement that he would be going, and the night before NBC announced Brian Williams out for 6 months, getting at the kind of truth that others wouldn't or couldn't quite get to, talking about Brian Williams and his what apparently tall tale about Iraq. But here's John Stewart.
Finally, someone is being held to account for misleading America about the Iraq war. Finally. Now, it might not necessarily be the first person you'd want held accountable on that list, but never again will Brian Williams mislead this great nation about being shot at in a war we probably wouldn't have ended up in if the media had applied this level of scrutiny to the actual war.
John Stewart on the night before all the big news here, going at maybe the bigger lie there. And Zara, I guess to your point, here's a guy willing to take it right on up to that level and say, hey, but what about?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think, and this week has been so odd in all the confluence of all these things because they're all so interrelated and they're all reporting about one another. But having John Stewart, that segment where there was kind of, you know, the part we didn't hear, which is kind of him delving into the personality and the celebrity quality of Brian Williams, and then kind of pointing out the absurdity of how the news media has treated this. You know, you have those two back to back, and that's really where you can see John Stewart just really hitting the nail on the head.
Zara Kessler, please stand by. Bloomberg View in New York. David Folkenflik of NPR in New York as well. Today we're looking at this amazing, unsettling week in media news. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is not the NBC Nightly News. No longer, as of this week, called the NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams. He's out for 6 months. This, in a week when Jon Stewart has announced he will leave The Daily Show, when longtime CBS correspondent Bob Simon dies in a car accident in Manhattan, when David Carr, legend, towering media critic for The New York Times, collapses in the newsroom and dies. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR, is with us. Zara Kessler, editor at Bloomberg View, joins us from New York City. Maybe let's deal first with Williams. Here he was offering an apology last Wednesday night for a story that he had repeatedly told that got a little more perhaps untruthful over the years. He tried to fold it in and make it okay. This was on the news broadcast Wednesday night a week ago.
I made a mistake in recalling the events of 12 years ago. It did not take long to hear from some brave men and women in the air crews who were also in that desert. I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft.
David Folkenflik, just on this one, by journalistic propriety, what's gone down with Brian Williams? The story got a little more fantastic. Each time he told it in very public places. He had talked about it on the NBC News just the week before. He wasn't in the helicopter that was shot down. He was following, but a half hour or an hour behind. Was NBC right to let him sort of dangle out there for days? Were they right to put him on a six-month suspension? Should he be gone?
You know, there's almost no point at which you can say that any of the actors involved here have really acted right. I think that, you know, it would seem from the outside, and we have not received the results. It's not 100% clear that we will receive the full results. But nonetheless, we haven't been told yet what the people who are conducting an internal review at NBC have come up with, in part because they haven't finished yet. Mm-hmm. So we don't know exactly all the facts. What we do know is that it almost seems like an Icarus tale where Brian Williams puffed himself up higher and higher to a point where finally he shot himself down, and that it wasn't a rocket-propelled grenade that took him down at all in that Chinook helicopter in March 2003 in the desert sands of Iraq. But actually that his helicopter went down and that he, you know, caught up with that crew sometime later. You know, one of the things you learn in life is that if you've done something wrong and you apologize, if your apology includes a but in there, you're not going to hear anything that precedes the but. What Brian Williams did in that January 30th broadcast of the NBC Nightly News, in which he retold a tale that he had conveyed on the David Letterman show and in other public settings, but not quite as explicitly as he did on NBC's own airwaves, in which he conveyed essentially an untruth with the imprimatur of the network newscast, you know, from its very set. And that became sort of an almost existential issue for NBC once it wasn't dealt with immediately. And it was called out by soldiers who had been there in the Iraqi desert that fateful day. So Williams did that. He does this apology and he says, but I was doing it in the context of trying to praise and pay tribute to this captain who really helped protect us. And it, you know, Williams, by all accounts, was downed for 2 days in the desert in a sandstorm. So there was concern there, and I'm sure there was heightened anxiety. What the network didn't do was it didn't take charge. It didn't say we need to not only apologize, we need to be very transparent about how this happened and why it happened and then move on. So it didn't do that. It allowed Williams to apologize and sort of wrap himself in the seeming mantle of the Army veterans who had kept him – or the soldiers who had kept him safe, rather than saying, I messed this up. I was not the one who was in peril at this time. And remember, it was an inconsequential episode to the war itself. The public's understanding was not heightened or deepened by Williams conveying this on January 30th. And so it really was a very self-inflicted wound for NBC, which drifted for about 10 days. It took a very severe and drastic act, in part because his credibility had been so damaged by the fact that they hadn't taken transparent steps in the days preceding.
Of course, the apology when it came from Brian Williams was not for an untruth. It was for a kind of offense to servicemen and women whose service may have been shadowed by his misrepresentation of what happened here. Here he was in that quote-unquote apology.
This was a bungled attempt by me to thank one special veteran and by extension our brave military men and women, veterans everywhere, those who have served while I did not. I hope they know they have my greatest respect and also now my apology.
John Stewart got right into this, the confluence of all these things in this week. But on Monday night, Zara, you were talking about this, where he brought up how Brian Williams, who was very good himself at comedy and therefore was a guest on 30 Rock, on Saturday Night Live, multiple times on the late night shows, very aware of how news was abutting and drifting into entertainment and kind of wanting to play in that field, proposed himself a couple of years back as a successor to Jay Leno, to NBC execs who did not go for that. Jon Stewart joked about all that on Monday night on The Daily Show.
We got us a case here of infotainment confusion syndrome. It occurs when the celebrity cortex gets its wires crossed with the medulla anchoradala. You can see when it happens. Watch. See how in 2003 he's looking straight at the camera, right? Medulla anchoradala appropriately regulating detail. That's a news story. But when he tells him 2013, notice how he turns his head. Look, his head is turned. A 45-degree angle activating the cerebellum. That's known as the brain's applause center. Once that engages, there's no going back.
Too much attention to celebrity, maybe. Too much awareness, maybe, of how entertainment has moved in on this turf. Mike in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What's the biggest story here, Mike?
Hi, Tom. I think the Brian Williams story is the biggest story, and I think the mistake is that they allowed him back then to become the news. He's not the news. He's a reporter. And for him to apologize for something that he said as a lie about himself is ridiculous. We all lie about ourselves. That's not the news. He didn't lie about the news. He lied about himself.
You know, in England, somebody was writing this week, they don't call them news anchors. They call them news readers. It sounds much more humble. I mean, Zara, does it matter to you if he's telling, you know, sort of puffed up tales about himself? Does it only matter what he reads from the news desk about the actual news?
No, I mean, I think of course it matters to me, the tales that he tells about himself. You know, you can't fully separate the two portions of his persona as celebrity figure and as reader of the news. And the problem is when they begin to intersect more and more and more, as we've seen here. I mean, I think that his prime responsibility was to read the news, as, you know, it was the NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams. That was his central location in our media landscape. It wasn't the, you know, it wasn't Brian Williams and Jimmy Fallon. And so that was his prime responsibility. That doesn't mean that if he's doing something in his celebrity sphere, if he's telling stories that aren't truthful, that doesn't bleed into what he's supposed to be doing every night on the news. He's one person and he's one figure in the news, and we can't try to separate and piece this out so that, you know, he's allowed to tell whatever tales he wants over here, but, you know, so long as he's not sitting in the anchor chair, that's fine. I mean, you have to see this as one whole picture.
David Flo Conflict, this goes right into the issue of trust and where Americans place trust these days. There was a time when the news anchor role, sort of Walter Cronkite era, David Carr say, well, there was no golden age, but there was kind of a very significant trust there. Brian Williams, very smart guy. He can see that people are willing to look into other arenas and have news approached in other ways. Jon Stewart, towering exhibit A of that. What does it say about where people look to understand the world today and where trust lies now? Does the straight news business have any kind of monopoly? Do they have more skepticism around them, David, these days? Are there even clear lines anymore when people look to know what's going on?
Well, the thing about Brian Williams that's really interesting is that unlike any other anchor, he almost presents a Janus face to the public that is looking backwards and forwards at the same time. He's a guy who has this stentorian voice of a kind of cadence where these compound, complex sentences would come cascading out of him like water out of a geyser.
No problem.
At times.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there'd be one funny punchline and edgy aside, knowingly sometimes directed at himself, sometimes at others, sometimes at Jon Stewart or David Letterman or whoever was with him that night when he was in other venues, that he was playing in both of these realms as a serious newsman who evoked a little bit of that voice of authority of that we think to ascribe to a Peter Jennings or a Walter Cronkite, and it's at the same time a wry, knowing, very postmodern, ironic take on the world's events as well. I think there, when you think about trust, it raises so many interesting questions with this particular episode, because part of what got Williams in trouble was telling a war story, mm-hmm. and a war story involving himself. And if you think of Tom Brokaw, he's, you know, in recent decade or so been so identified with his recounting the tale of the Greatest Generation, the armed forces who fought in World War II. And Williams himself clearly embraced the veterans of this Iraq War and this era. You know, he was on the board of the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation or Society, which supports the men and women who have been recognized with that medal from the government of recognition for their service. And, you know, yet he's inflating the peril that he faced. His apology, I think it's very, very telling. When you listen to that just moments ago, he talked about his apology to the veterans, the respect he had for them. And these are ways in which anchors like politicians can get trust from the public, is to attach yourself or connect with certain segments of society that themselves are very revered by the public. At no point in his apology, at least in that public apology on the newscast, did Williams address the audience. Did Williams address his obligation as a journalist? Not simply to honor veterans, which I respect, but to cover the military as a story, to point out their achievements and their shortcomings and the ways we fail them and the ways that society takes care of them and the panoply of issues surrounding them, and keeping faith with the public and the audience in performing his public duty. That's not what his apology got at, and I think it was one of the fundamental ways in which it fell short.
A kind of wrapping in the flag going on there that, as you say, we know well from politics. Colin in Nashville, Tennessee. Colin, you're on the air.
Yes, hello all. I wanted to just register my opinion that Jon Stewart, for me, is the biggest story of the week. Huge fan of David Carr, and I was very saddened to hear the news about his passing, because he is he's still got his finger on the pulse of the media landscape, but it was Jon Stewart for me and my generation, I'm 29, that taught me to pay attention in the first place. He's sort of been my guy since I've been awake, really. He really showed us a great humor with which to handle all the bad news, but also sort of helped us to know what to pay attention to.
Jon Stewart, Colin, that's tall praise. The man who taught you how to pay attention. Here's Stewart. This was on Tuesday night, talking about his plans to leave the show sometime later this year.
17 years is the longest I have ever in my life held a job by 16 years and 5 months. Thank you. The upshot there being, I am a terrible employee. But in my heart, I know it is time for someone else to have that opportunity. And
he's restless, and the whole country of followers of Jon Stewart. Of course, not everyone's a fan, but those who are, and they are many, kind of like to know why. But here he's talking about he's himself being a restless host.
This show doesn't deserve an even slightly restless host, and neither do you. I don't think I'm going to miss being on television every day. I'm going to miss coming here every day. And this is where I love the people here. They're the best. They're creative and collaborative and kind, and that's alliterative, but it's cheating because it's a K. But you understand what I'm saying. I love them and respect them so much.
We love you, John!
Yeah!
Zara Kessler, does it make sense to you? Have you been watching? Could you see the restlessness? He went off and made a film for several months about an Iranian journalist. Was it the summer of 2013? Could you see Jon Stewart putting on his parachute?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, especially when he went off to make the film, kind of started to get the sense that maybe the end was coming. And I think it's a decision that someone makes. He's saying, I'm going to step down at the top of my game, and I'm going to lead the way for someone. Someone else will fill that role. He has not, I mean, we haven't talked about this in great detail, but he's not only over the last, you know, over a decade and a half, hasn't only been the host of this show. He's also, you know, spurred the careers of several other people in this community of satiric news. And we have John Oliver, and we for a long time had Stephen Colbert. And so, I mean, I think he's this paternal figure. He's this figure at the height of his importance and his ability to shape the public conversation. And he's saying maybe it's time to step down. I think that it wasn't a huge shock to a lot of people who knew the show well. But I also think that doesn't mean it's any less of a disappointment. You could audibly hear the audience there and yeah, hear what, you know, the kind of an emotional gut reaction there, and there's this weird thing where he knows the TV audience is going to know what's going to happen, and the live audience doesn't, and there's this interplay. But all of us, even the people, those of us who are watching later, kind of were waiting to hear, what does he have to say? Why is he doing this? Why is he doing this to us and to our country and to young people everywhere? How can we go to 2016 into the election without having Jon Stewart? So yes, not necessarily a shock, definitely still a huge disappointment.
And now the interplay of expectations. Will Jon Stewart go into some kind of news role? You've got some people saying you should take Brian Williams' old chair. Will Brian Williams go into the entertainment realm? David Falkenflik, do you take either of those seriously?
I think that we will probably hear from them both in different roles than they have been, somewhat different roles than they have been playing. But I'm not sure what that will be. I think that part of what Stewart has clearly signaled is that he intends to give himself a little time to figure it out. He's not even clear on when he's leaving the show, and that, you know, he will need to disengage, much like a student leaving college or somebody, you know, deciding to take a second career. You know, he is going to have to think about what he wants to do. Remember, he was a stand-up comic. He had been a guy who had thought of himself as one of these young comics who would go on to host something like The Tonight Show or something like David Letterman's show one day. And his good friend and colleague and compatriot Stephen Colbert is doing exactly that. I think Jon Stewart ultimately pass that by, and he's going to figure out a new path for himself. I'm looking forward to seeing what it is.
He has said lately that comedy is less interesting to him now after these Daily Show years of wading deep into the news. We'll see. Big movements this week. Jon Stewart, Brian Williams, Bob Simon, David Carr. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Music from The Daily Show. Their theme behind us right here. Jon Stewart saying he will leave. Brian Williams out for 6 months at least at NBC this week. Of course, Bob Simon, longtime 60 Minutes and CBS correspondent, dead in a car accident in New York City. And David Carr, the kind of incredible media critic for the New York Times, collapsing in the newsroom and dying yesterday at 58. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR, is with us. Zara Kessler, editor at Bloomberg View, joins us as well. Who do you trust now in the news? We've got lots, Zara and David, of response online here. Scott says, Jon Stewart, so much of it about Jon Stewart. Interesting. Jon Stewart gave us so many great tools to use in our Swiss army knives of words and arguments against bad government and ideas. Chris writes, Jon Stewart seemed to be the only person talking about politics on television with the same incredulity that we all feel. And we saw that acted out many times. Divine writes to us. She says, thinking of your age, Zara, she says, I am a multiple of 24, and I completely agree with Zara regarding Jon Stewart. He had a talent of exposing the kernel of truth underlying the news that is brilliant. Amy doesn't want us to bury him quite yet. She says, he reminded us he's not dead. Who's to say he won't do something equally epic? David, Rajesh writes, as a news junkie, I am addicted to The Daily Show. Got to figure out what to do with those extra 30 minutes every day. What about that, David? Do you think they can find somebody else to slide into that seat who will have Jon Stewart's appeal? Can you see who that person might be? And let's say that Rajesh can't find it at The Daily Show. Where do fans of that show invest that 30 minutes that they might get something that would give them the same payoff, David?
Look, I'm an admirer of Jon Stewart and of Stephen Colbert and his persona in those 30 minutes that followed for those 9 years. And at the same time, neither the Jon Stewart who took over in, I think, 1999, nor the Stephen Colbert who spent the 9 years there were the figures we think of now when they started. And you see this time and again. David Carr, you know, joined the New York Times essentially in 2002 to cover publishing, and emerged as really one of the nation's premier media critics in a way that was important. People evolve. There are gaps in needs in our culture, and people rise up to fill those. They then shape those gaps to and those roles into a form that makes sense to them. But I don't think Jon Stewart knew exactly the direction he'd take. I think he was shaped by the election recount disaster for the media and for the nation, the many weeks of uncertainty we're plunged into. I think he was shaped by 9/11, and I think he was shaped very much by the wars that unfolded in the months and years that followed. And he decided to do what he didn't see in the media. You know, at NPR, reporters and I have had conversations about ways in which we take techniques that he's used to hold people accountable and use people's tape to hold them accountable in ways that even if you think of Tim Russert on Meet the Press on NBC, the late Tim Russert, who's an awfully good interviewer and at times interrogator, even went beyond, I think, what Russert did to hold people accountable for their rhetoric and their statements. And so I'm sorry that Jon Stewart's not going to be doing it again, but I also recognize the guy deserves to follow the career that makes sense to him. And I think that we have to look out for other fascinating new voices that will emerge, whether from Vice and BuzzFeed and Vox or Comedy Central. You could imagine an Asif Manvi, if she wanted to return to TV, Amy Poehler. I've seen other names floated. You know, John Oliver, I think, has in a sense already pre-succeeded him in this weekly show on HBO. You know, there are other people you can see doing this, but regardless of whether that show continues to hold exactly the same role it does in our mind space in popular culture, I think other figures will emerge that will in some ways address the kinds of concerns and interests people have.
People grow up. They step up. A decade ago, Jon Stewart, there he was on CNN on Crossfire, that show, and suddenly he's criticizing the show for fundamentally hurting America, he said, for their style of debate there. Got into a spirited debate himself with the show's co-host Tucker Carlson. Crossfire was canceled just months later. Here's a little bit of that exchange.
You're doing theater when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
You do debate. No, it's not honest.
What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And I'll tell you why I know it.
You have John Kerry on your show, and you sniff his throne, and you're accusing us of partisan hackery?
Absolutely.
You've got to be kidding me.
You're on CNN. The show that leads into me is puppets making crank phone calls. What is wrong with you?
John Stewart, 2004. Ginny in Edna, Kansas. Ginny, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I find it difficult to express my words after so many words have been said with such eloquence. All I can say is I'm a senior citizen, and my entire family was just saddened terribly when Colbert quit. And now with Stewart planning to leave, we don't know where to turn. We've never really watched network news for years. I think maybe influenced on that from Good Morning Vietnam when you found out the newscasters can only say what they're allowed to say by big money or whoever else is controlling the news. Stewart actually had credibility when he criticized other newscasters, which in this part of the country, Kansas and Oklahoma, that's all anybody watches is Fox News. Sorry to say. But Stewart could bring up the facts that these people were presenting and then say, here's where you said it three different ways. Which one do you mean? And at a point, I could barely watch Stewart even, because to watch these politicians with their lies and dishonesty and ignorance, it was just painful to even watch that. So, and Stewart himself looked so tired and worn by just the experience of trying to keep honesty in the country, and that's about all I can really say about that. But actually, my sons and I both agree that we would really like to see Jessica Williams take over Stewart's place. She's got the spark and the excitement that I think she could bring.
Ginny, you've got a few more months of John Stewart. Who knows where else he might show up, but we hear that fervent fandom right there and appreciation out of Edna, Kansas. If I may, let me get one more. Thank you, Ginny. Montgomery, Alabama. Doug, you're on.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Pretty good. What do you think?
So I'm thinking it would be nice. The wife and I were talking yesterday. It would be nice to see John on a nightly news show. I mean, replacing either Brian Williams or whoever's stepping off from another network. And credibility, 16 years of credibility, you know, it's got to be worth something. You know, that, or, you know, we were more on the playful side. We were saying, what if he's pulling a Huckabee to run something in 2016? You know, but that's just what we were thinking.
Going for the White House there, you think, Doug? Just maybe. Doug, I've got it. Let me hold that and take it to Zara Kessler in just a second. One more here from Detroit. Walter, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
And guests. I would like to believe that if John Stewart was participating in the discussion today, he wouldn't be inflating his own reputation. John Stewart critiqued the news. He didn't gather the news. He didn't have a news bureau. He didn't have correspondence. He didn't even have a newsroom. Granted, he was terrific at what he did, but to place him alongside network news anchors, I just don't see it. Maybe it's a generational thing.
Walter, let me respond. He did certainly critique the news. He was kind of made a mockery of certain parts of the news business, but with his staff, he also went after politicians, leaders, responsible people. He held them to account just by putting what they said here and what they said there up on air and analyzing it. Let me take it to Zara Kessler. You hear Walter in Detroit, Zara, saying, John Stewart, not a journalist. We know he started as a stand-up comic. When you look at him today, do you see, as a 24-year-old in the business, do you see a journalist in John Stewart, Zara?
I do see a journalist in John Stewart. I think that, you know, part of the news is gathering the news. Part of the news is compiling the news and giving it structure and pointing out gaps and flaws and inconsistencies. That being said, I think you make a good point in the sense that we have to remember here, you know, what the core of journalism is. And this week we've lost a lot of people that are really important to that. I mean, good reporting, great war reporting on the ground, correspondents, people flying around the world and getting other people's perspectives. And the basis of journalism lies in that. And it lies in picking up the phone and calling someone. It lies in being able to get the politician on the air saying something. John Stewart did a lot of great things, and he did a lot of kind of taking pieces of what other people have gathered and figuring out and commenting upon that. But I do think that this is also a week to remember the importance of really good on the ground, cutthroat, you know, deep digging journalism. And the losses of Bob Simon and David Carr are huge losses, especially as someone in the journalism world. Just looking last night on Twitter is often a terrible place. But last night, it was, as a young journalist, it was a really heartwarming, amid this terrible, terrible news, to see how one journalist could touch the lives and teach the tools of the trade to so many people that I admire so much. It really reminds you of what the business is all about.
Let's hear that one-of-a-kind voice of Bob Simon for a second here. This is back in 2011, long-time foreign correspondent for CBS 60 Minutes. He was opening up here in an interview with a Columbia University journalism student, saying journalism isn't just a job, it's a life.
If you're a general reporter, the most wonderful thing about it, not only as a job but as a life, is that you get into so many worlds. We did a couple of boxing stories. I'd never been to a boxing match. You know, what do I know from boxers? And that's the best thing about being in this game, is just getting into other people's worlds.
David Folkenflik, Bob Simon's career coincided with a kind of golden age, certainly economically for much of it. He started in the 1960s in Vietnam. He worked through many years when the news networks were really at the top of their influence, the top of their revenues. You could be that reporter, be supported and paid and sent out into the field again and again. Do we have new generations coming up into a news system that's going to support that kind of reporting, David?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. But it's not the same. It's not, you know, I walked into the Baltimore Sun over 20 years ago as a young reporter, and there were 9 foreign bureaus. And I think at its height during my decade there, there were about 400 employees. I'm told now there are closer to about 125 or so employees there. There are no foreign bureaus instead of 15,
yeah,
you know, Washington correspondents, of whom I was one in the 90s. There's, I believe, a shared one person down there. It's just a very different age. Bob Simon was asked in that very video by a terrific young Columbia student who's gone on to become a professional journalist what he would do for himself if he were now entering the field. And he said, I think I'd probably try to write for the New York Times. And the student was just dumbstruck that a correspondent for 60 Minutes, you know, the pinnacle of broadcast journalism, a terrific magazine at its best, mm-hmm, you know, would say that. And Simon's like, look, you know, TV, I don't know. It doesn't really feel right for me. I'm not a great looking guy. He then said to the interviewer, you're not that good looking a guy, for you don't look like a TV anchor either. But he said, you know, the journalism part is what's exciting. And he, like all, I think, journalists fundamentally, looked at the reporter's notebook, or in his case, the camera, as something like a passport that gave him entry into all these different worlds, where he got to go knock on doors or visit places and see what happened. In Bob Simon's case, quite literally, it was a passport to the world. He covered almost every major conflict you could come up with in the last 4 decades and from Vietnam on. And he got an insight and an understanding and a texture of how the world worked that I think so greatly benefited the viewers of CBS. You know, he's a guy who didn't puff up his experiences. He was held during the first Gulf War for about 40 days, yeah, with 3 of his CBS colleagues. He was beaten. He was starved for that time. And it's believed that the release was only occasioned by the intervention of then Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. He's not a guy who boasted about that routinely. He did grapple with it in a book and talk about it a bit after. But, you know, an understated and overaccomplished man of great insight, a true reporter. You don't have to be a journalist to provide insight in the public realm. I think people think that there are neat lines, and I think the modern age with social media platforms and blogs and the like have blurred a lot of those lines. So a guy like Jon Stewart with humor can add something to the public conversation. But someone like Bob Simon, who, you know, goes abroad, or somebody like David Carr, who reports keenly even as he's providing criticism of the media, do a great service, I think, to the public conversation in a way that's hard to match.
It's a huge week in media news. Let's hear one more chunk from David Carr. This was December 2013. We heard him say earlier, don't look back to a golden age of journalism as if it's all gone. But he did point to the risks with new media, people getting down in their own echo chambers. Here's a little extended clip from, sadly, past yesterday, David Carr, media critic for The New York Times.
If you want to go out on the net and find out that the last president knocked down the World Trade Centers, that the current president, yeah, it was born in Kenya, you can. You can say it must be true. I saw it on the internet. What has been lost is the village common, this place where we all agree. And as the caller before that pointed out, we don't want information from just an in-group of crusty old white guys, right? But the one thing about that is we all ended up with this sort of fact base in common. And so what we have now is people who are shouting from various chasms of belief, and they think they are in possession of the facts. When I get letters from people when I write about anything that's vaguely ideological, they're so convinced of what they're saying and the amount of condescension that they bring to it in terms of, you just don't understand, you just don't see. And what they've been doing is shouting down a well and hearing their own echo come back.
David Carr, with me here at On Point in 2013, collapsed in the newsroom at the New York Times yesterday at 58 and died. In the same week that Bob Simon is gone, Brian Williams, out of his chair for 6 months at NBC, and Jon Stewart saying he will leave The Daily Show. David Folkenflik, do you think Brian Williams can possibly come back to the anchor's chair?
I think it's going to depend on two things, one of which will be if the team that's doing the internal review, led by an experienced investigative reporter, Rich Esposito, who's a producer at NBC, comes up with anything equally bad or worse than the story that got him into this trouble in the first place. I think the fact that they did not go outside was a mistake by NBC, but they can only rectify that by being fully transparent about what's found. The second thing is, you know, and I know from talking to people at NBC, that the executives at NBC and their corporate parent Comcast are going to keep a piercing eye on how the ratings do while he's gone. And if they stay relatively stable, it's going to be very hard to make the case for Brian Williams to come back, no matter what the review finds. And if those ratings plunge, you might well see the nation's top watch news anchor back in that chair.
Zara Kessler, just a couple of seconds here. What will you do with your 30 Daily Show minutes after Jon Stewart goes, Zara?
I'm waiting to see who's going to be the best one to watch. I mean, there are a lot of people who are coming up in Jon Stewart's footsteps, and we'll see which of them grabs my attention and which of them grabs the attention of my fellow millennials.
Everybody paying attention now. Zara Kessler at Bloomberg View, David Folkenflik with NPR. Great thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.